This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, are we witnessing the politics of fear? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. We're back with our periodic update of the U.S. presidential campaign for 2016. Republican and Democratic presidential hopefuls are weighing in on the fallout from the recent terror attacks in Paris. While much of the world is united in sympathy for the victims, and Europe and the United States are renewing their determination to counter the so-called Islamic State, some politicians have fanned the flames of public fear and seized the tragic moment for partisan advantage. After the terrorist attacks in Paris, some Republican politicians began calling for a halt to the U.S. resettlement of Syrian refugees or for the resettlement of only Christian refugees. They argue that would help prevent terrorists from entering the United States. But U.S. President Barack Obama has denounced such ideas, saying, quote, "We are not well served when in response to a terrorist attack, we descend into fear and panic," unquote. The debate over U.S. plans to resettle 10,000 Syrians mirrors discussions across Europe over whether resettlement endangers security. More than two dozen U.S. governors have also signaled they plan to block Syrian refugees from resettling in their states, even though there is scant evidence that such refugees pose a serious threat, given that refugees are among the most highly vetted people to set foot on U.S. soil. President Obama argues the rhetoric is contrary to American values and helps Islamic State militants. He called on lawmakers instead to introduce legislation to authorize military activities to counter Islamic State in Syria. However, instead of debating the need for a renewed authorization to use military force, also known as an AUMF, or discussing a bipartisan suggestion by Republican Senator Jeff Flake and Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein that the United States tighten up the so-called visa waiver system that allows people from a list of countries, including France, to visit the United States without a visa. Now, let's not forget that the perpetrators of the Paris attacks were not refugees, but homegrown terrorists with European passports. Many U.S. lawmakers, including about four dozen Democrats, passed legislation that would halt the resettlement of Syrian and Iraqi refugees in the United States and overhaul the screening process. President Obama, who threatened to veto the legislation, and many Democrats have said barring Syrian and Iraqi refugees would be contrary to American values and a strategic blunder in the effort to combat the spread of Islamic State ideology. With us to discuss the U.S. political landscape and campaign 2016 in the aftermath of the Paris attacks are our regular contributors. John Fortier is director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a think tank based here in Washington, and Igor Volsky. He's director of video and contributing editor of thinkprogress.org at the Center for American Progress. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us, Carol.
Well, Igor Volsky, let me begin with you to talk about this so-called politics of fear that we're witnessing. Certainly, it's legitimate to discuss the fallout from these terrorist attacks, to look at legislation to bolster our national security. But it does appear, as I suggested, that some politicians are proposing measures which are either antithetical to that or playing up to stereotypes, both of which are counterproductive, to say the least. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, they're really, truly exploiting this tragedy for political gain. When Donald Trump says, let's monitor mosques, let's make a list of Muslims, when Marco Rubio endorses a similar idea, when Jeb Bush says that let's only let Christians into the country, it's really challenging, I think, because not only is that kind of rhetoric, as the president laid out, contradictory to American values and American democracy, but it will also do nothing to keep America safer. You mentioned the visa waiver program, which is something lawmakers are looking at and thinking, should we allow people who have been to Iraq or Syria, say, in the last year, but are entering the country from France or Brussels or some other country on the no visa list, should they be vetted? Should they be required to obtain a visa? And all of that makes sense. Rational policy prescription in the aftermath of Paris makes sense. Fear-mongering is, I think, just a very, very sad and poor political ploy.
Turning to you, John Fortier, and I think it's interesting and relevant to note a contrast in tone and substance from the way some of the Republican candidates are reacting to this tragedy and how former Republican President George W. Bush reacted in the wake of 9/11. In the wake of 9/11 attacks, he made it very clear that we are not at war with Islam. He went to mosques, etc., in order to protect the majority of Muslims who have nothing to do with these attacks. And, of course, we also witness French President François Hollande, whose country was attacked, but who said, and he underscored and reiterated that, nonetheless, that they will be accepting Syrian refugees. So your reaction to what's going on, and particularly some of the presidential contenders and their reactions?
Well, I do think you see rhetoric descending in a way, especially from the front runner, Donald Trump, and policies of excluding Muslims particularly, which are getting some pushback. But I think on the other side, you see a deteriorating situation. These are issues that are caused in part by all of the problems that are flowing from the Syria problem and debates that we are having in Europe as well about what the right mix of immigration is, but also what the right mix of security is. I guess I would say this. If you look beyond the rhetoric, you look to some votes that took place in the Congress. The House of Representatives asked the president and his cabinet to certify that they would be keeping terrorists out of the country in this program. Also, just generally, some calls for a pause or some reconsideration of what we're doing. I think that is something that has gained a lot of traction with the American people. You saw 47 Democrats voting for this sort of approach, feeling that the administration really is insisting on this refugee policy as the end-all be-all and really not doing enough to address terrorism. I think underlying this are worries about immigration, but also worries about the president's general foreign policy and dealing with terrorism. His numbers on dealing with terrorism are at an all-time low for his administration. The country doesn't feel comfortable with his policies. They are more likely to turn to Republicans, both on the direct aspects of foreign policy and in the immigration fallout on this. So I share your worries about some of the overblown rhetoric as to what might be done. But I think when you get to the sort of practical policies, the president is fighting against public opinion at this point.
You know, if I may add, it's hard to make the argument that the response we saw, certainly the congressional response, that that's not guided to some degree by, frankly, religious discrimination. I mean, 3 out of the 8 attackers in Paris were from Brussels. Are we banning all flights from Brussels? Are we saying let's pause all flights? I mean, a lot of them are homegrown in France. Are we going after those flights? Are we figuring out how to block French people from coming into America or to make it harder to have additional security checks? We're not. We're looking at people from certain parts of the world. And in fact, people who are fleeing the very terrorists who we are fighting, who are much more intimately familiar with the kind of savagery that they perform day in and day out, and people who live their own Paris every single day are being kept from coming into this country. We sadly have a long history of this when we didn't let Jews in during the Holocaust. And it really has to stop. And again, rational policy options make sense. These kinds of overreactions are tragic. And we're going to look at this 10, 20, even 5 years from today and be embarrassed at ourselves.
I think we are going to have a longer term discussion of where we want to get. But I think it is not an unreasonable pause or policy to think in the short term that we should be very cautious about these things. ISIS itself has said that it will be sending people along with the refugees. It's not the refugees' fault. We certainly see people coming to Syria, coming back to Europe. It's a greater problem in Europe by far, of course. The United States, much harder to deal with this. But it is something that we shouldn't take lightly. And I think the American people are concerned enough now that a pause or some sort of reconsideration for the short term is warranted, and the president seems determined to push forward no matter what with this, and I think the public is against him.
Here's a big irony. Before the terror attacks in Paris, people were criticizing Obama on all sides of the political spectrum for taking in so few, 10,000, and that's a drop in the bucket. And now even that paltry number is under siege because of what happened and all the politics surrounding it, which is really very unfortunate. But let's talk about the Democrats, and let's pick up a point that John Fortier made about President Obama and all kinds of criticism among his own former advisors about how he has approached dealing with the crisis in Syria, countering terrorism. He is being criticized by many of his former advisors, including Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton. She's coming out with her own national security plan. She, among others, former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta and former CIA director David Petraeus, all of them said back in 2012 that we should, that is, the United States should have taken a greater role, provided defensive weaponry, done more to help the peaceful Syrian opposition and the defectors from the army. So let's take a look at the criticism that President Obama has been under with respect to his policy to counter the Islamic State and to solve the Syrian civil war.
I'm not going to argue that President Obama handled the Syrian crisis from the very beginning perfectly, or that he couldn't have done more, or that he should have done more and maybe avoided to some degree the situation we're in today. But the very same people, David Petraeus, the former CIA director, said very clearly that the criticism that is coming towards Obama, which is, let's send more special forces, let's have a bigger ground presence, let's de-escalate the rules of engagement when it comes to the war campaign, that is, be more liberal in the way you deploy your air war, that those tactics are going to backfire in the Middle East. And while they may create a victory over the short term, over the long term, because there isn't the kind of, and John can certainly speak to this, the kind of political foundation for resolution to the Syria crisis and, of course, building up in Iraq, that it's ultimately going to be a victory that's going to be lost. And I think very often in the media, in our political conversation, action is equated with a strong, bellicose military response. And the president, I think, is speaking out against that and saying, if we learned one thing from Iraq, from Afghanistan, it's that a strong American troop presence is not the way to go. It may, in fact, make the situation even worse, as we learn from the rise of ISIS.
On the other hand, John Fortier, Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton, certainly a former member of Obama's cabinet, Secretary of State, again, is coming up with a more nuanced approach. She said, of course, you can't deal with ISIS unless you also are willing to deal with Assad. We don't hear a lot of that. We hear a lot of rhetoric from the administration, how Assad has to go, but then not concomitant action. She's also calling for greater cooperation from our Gulf Arab allies and Turkey and other measures. But what about constructive ideas, strategies on the part of Republican candidates, aside from, you know, keeping out refugees and sending in more troops? Are you hearing any voices out there, and is that gaining traction?
First, starting with the president. The president is not unpopular today. I wouldn't say he's popular. He's sort of in the middle. But his numbers on foreign policy have dropped dramatically since the first term. And you could say that many people are still with him. It hasn't overall hurt him. But to some of Igor's points, I think the president does make a big point that he is not George W. Bush, and that policy was wrong, and that was some of the cause of all that's going on. And the American people, I think, are worried a little bit about weaker leadership, but that's not probably their biggest concern. What I think the American people really start to pay attention when it turns more to issues of terrorism. And we saw this when ISIS was more actively beheading American citizens. The turn in Paris today, they may worry about Obama's leadership in some areas, but when they start to see it become more about terrorism security, you can say that's fear-mongering, or you can say that that's concerned with their interest. I think they're perking up a bit. And so it's become a more serious issue because it is connected with terrorism. And is America war-weary about sending troops? Yes, in a way. But they're also, I think, more concerned about these issues, and the president is not doing well there. Do Republicans have the answer on this? I don't think they do, in an obvious way, that the ways of getting out of this situation are very difficult. But I think the sense that even Hillary Clinton is putting out a bit, and that Republicans are making much more strongly, is that the president isn't doing enough and that there's a vacuum. And a lot of these consequences have followed from that. And if it's not boots on the ground, there may be other measures that would be serious enough to get something done. And the president is the one who's ultimately responsible for that.
You know, a lot of this goes back to, I think, how we define weakness. This idea that weakness is using the tools of diplomacy that you have both in the region and on the ground in Syria and Iraq to build a coalition of forces to go after ISIS, to build and help put an exit strategy in place for Assad to move out of power. The fact that that's defined as weakness is quite astounding, because if we learned anything from George W. Bush is that our traditional definitions of strength, of shock and awe, of just destroy the place That's not strength. That is a form of weakness, because real strength is having the ability to sew that place back together and to make sure that radical elements like ISIS, like all the other terrorist groups, don't have the space to operate. And that takes real work and real commitment and real coalition building, and is actually, frankly, a whole lot harder to do than simply drop some bombs, kill ISIS, and say, we're done, and kind of live through those higher approval ratings that you have. It's the hard work, and that's actually the strength of a foreign policy, I think, that Obama may not do enough of, that Hillary says she will try to escalate. But that, I think, that should be our definition of a strong foreign policy, not simply dropping bombs and sending boots to foreign lands.
And quickly, before we go to a break, there are some voices on the Republican side, John Fortier, who are advocating that type of policy. John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, comes to mind, although his poll ratings are pretty low.
And oddly enough, you even see someone like Donald Trump, the leader, who has said some things I can't say on the air about what we should do to ISIS, but has also made a point that he was a critic of Bush going into Iraq and of a certain type of American engagement in the world. So there are some tensions on the Republican side and some worries about going in too far and overextending and putting boots on the ground. And yet there seems to be, you know, a lot of policy options that are in the middle, and Hillary Clinton is trying to stake out a bit of that. I think the big question is, this is a bad situation, and maybe it has bad options for it. But as much as all of these things flow from Syria, whether it's refugees, whether it's terrorism, whether it's having the Russians directly engaged in a place that they weren't as directly engaged in, a lot of these things are not good for America. And unless we deal with the situation more fundamentally, those consequences are bad for the president in a political sense.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are John Fortier, from whom you just heard. He's director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a think tank here in Washington. And Igor Volsky, he's director of video and contributing editor of thinkprogress.org at the Center for American Progress, also here in Washington. We're talking about the U.S. political landscape and campaign 2016. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find that download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel, VOA, or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to a loyal listener from Nairobi, Kenya, Ankolo Mushiri. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook. Well, back to you, Igor Volsky, to talk about the campaign, particularly who's up, who's down on both sides. Let's take a look at the Democrats. Since you were last here in the studio, there's been a new Democratic debate. Talk about Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton.
Well, I don't know if there's much to say about Martin O'Malley, frankly.
On the other hand.
On the other hand, certainly you've seen with these Paris attacks some of the enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders and the economic message predominantly that he puts forward, some of that really wane. And in the aftermath of the debate in Iowa, there was this real sense that when it comes to performing the functions of commander-in-chief, Bernie Sanders doesn't seem very interested in that aspect of the job. And so greater attention, I think, shifted to Hillary, and she was able to consolidate some of her support in Iowa and New Hampshire. And so in terms of the politics and the horse race, I think in this new kind of era that we're in of post-Paris, the Sanders campaign is really going to have to figure out how to credibly weave a foreign policy message that resonates with Democrats into his more populist economic rhetoric.
John Fortier, your take on the Democratic horse race in the so-called post-Paris environment.
We've always had a similar situation, in that Hillary Clinton is a very strong front runner, and that she was going to get a challenge from her left, and that was going to be filled by someone. And that challenge was going to be partly about foreign policy, and that she was a little hawkish, too hawkish for the party, and partly about not really making enough of the inequality issues and economic populism. Bernie Sanders is the candidate who is filling that role, but he's not the strongest candidate in the world. You could imagine an Elizabeth Warren, a senator from Massachusetts, would have been a stronger person to take that mantle. Also, if you look back to how Barack Obama beat Hillary Clinton, which was a very tough race and tough for him to beat her, he essentially had that vote. He had the anti-war vote, the kind of white liberal vote, as well as African Americans, which is a very strong part of the party, maybe about a quarter of voters in the Democratic primary. That was just enough to get him to 52% to beat Hillary Clinton. You look today, Bernie Sanders, I think the best he can hope for is having some of that white liberal protest vote. If he's lucky, that could lead to doing well in the first couple of states, Iowa and New Hampshire. I'm not sure he could even win them today, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. But even if he were to do that, the states after that are much more favorable to Hillary Clinton. So it's hard to see her losing. She's a strong candidate and she has weak opposition.
Turning back to you, Igor Volsky, now to the Republican horse race. Now, notwithstanding what some would characterize as inflammatory remarks by the front runners, both Donald Trump and even Ben Carson, with respect to Syrian refugees, immigration, they're still up there. Then Rubio. Talk about the candidates and their relative chances.
In the aftermath of Paris, I was surprised to see that Donald Trump's numbers increased a bit. He seems to have steadied his lead over Ben Carson, who's dropping for different reasons, mostly to do with his past and truthfulness. But also people like Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who are really setting themselves up as an alternative to maybe Trump, but as certainly as contenders in a top two or top three kind of race. And I think that has been fairly impressive. And so, if anything, I think we've seen the field kind of shrink a bit, in my mind, to Trump, Cruz, who's making, I think, a very credible run for the anti-establishment candidate that Republicans sometimes rally around, and Marco Rubio, who's kind of more establishment in that sense, but has had impressive debate performances and I think has wooed some of the kind of more moneyed traditional Republican donor base.
Back to you, John Fortier, for your take on the Republican horse race and who's up and who's down and why.
The two frontrunners of the polls are still Donald Trump with a significant lead and Ben Carson. You have a candidate there who really wasn't well known by the Republican base, looked at him, they liked him broadly, but hadn't had much of a negative said about him. He didn't have high negatives. That's starting to change. The two other candidates that are coming up are Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. Ted Cruz, I think, is there to fill the role of Ben Carson with religious conservatives. Marco Rubio looks like he's beginning to be the candidate of the establishment, but in a way that Jeb Bush couldn't be. He's both got moderate and more establishment Republicans, but has a kind of foot in the conservative camp, foot in the Tea Party camp. I think we may see a real narrowing of the race to those three if Ben Carson continues to fall. And what that means is we're really not talking about Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush is not out of the race, still has some resources, but has found no way to break through. And I think in every poll finds himself only having the most left-wing of Republicans. And that's no way to win a primary. I think that these three are the ones to watch.
Well, gentlemen, as we close, quick question with respect to a new Speaker of the House since you were last at these VOA microphones. John Boehner has stepped down, and now we have Paul Ryan as Republican Speaker of the House. So, Igor Volsky, your take on his leadership style and what he can or cannot do for the remainder of the year.
Well, I think it's a bit too early to tell. Certainly, I think he was a candidate who conservatives felt really had their ear moving forward in a way that John Boehner or some of the other candidates didn't. And so it's going to be a big test as we move forward with some of the critical bills to see how much conservative priorities that Democrats won't kind of play ball with will make it into some key pieces of legislation and how he'll be able to navigate those waters and whether or not he's really going to be a speaker who seeks consensus with the whole of the House or one who just kind of moves right as his party does, which is something that Boehner kind of struggled with as well.
Well, the last word to you, John Fortier, on Speaker Ryan's leadership style and what he can accomplish.
Paul Ryan was the top choice of every Republican in the caucus to have. He was a nice figure to bring in when current speaker was leaving, is respected by conservatives. We've taken some of the difficult issues off the table with the budget deal being done. I think he has some opportunities to reach out on issues like tax reform and infrastructure that maybe they could do together. Down the road, the caucus is still fractured. There's still a very conservative element who might not be that easy to bring along on all sorts of deals. But I think for this Congress, he's in a very good position. It will be interesting to see if there's a Ryan with a Republican president or a Democratic president, how he holds together his caucus. The tensions that John Boehner faced are still there, but he's really a great leader for Republicans. They couldn't have hoped for better in terms of looking at their caucus and getting their number one choice.
All right, gentlemen, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Igor Volsky, Director of Video and Contributing Editor of ThinkProgress.org at the Center for American Progress, and John Fortier. He's Director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. As always, thank you for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Audrius Regas. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.